with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, residents of the Warm Springs Reservation prepare for a water outage as the Root Feast celebration begins. The Republican governor of Indiana vetoes a bill banning transgender athletes from high school sports. And in international news, more than 3.5 million refugees flee as Ukrainian officials say some cities have been bombed beyond recognition. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 22, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Thousands of residents of the Warm Springs Reservation in North Central Oregon are preparing to live without running water following an electrical fire that knocked out a transformer at the drinking water treatment plant on Friday. Officials with the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs have declared an emergency and issued a water conservation notice for the agency water system, which serves the most populated areas of the reservation. Currently, about 4,000 people are being asked to brace for water outages. Pacific Power crews removed the burnt transformer on Monday, but tribal leaders and Pacific Power have declined to comment on how long repairs would likely take. The water outage comes just as the Warm Springs community begins one of the most important cultural events of the year, preparations for the Root Feast. During the celebration, women gather roots over the course of 5 days, culminating in a ceremony on Sunday to give thanks for the start of spring, the renewal of first food sources, and for clean water. Problems with the reservation's water infrastructure have risked human health and posed environmental concerns for years. More than 2 years ago, the tribes convened with federal and state agencies to find money for needed upgrades. But those talks have yet to yield a concrete plan for a new drinking water treatment plant. Politicians in Oregon have said that the $1 trillion Infrastructure Act the state passed in November will aid in bringing water stability to Warm Springs. The state agency that oversees public defense in Oregon announced Monday it would resume paying district attorneys discovery fees after cutting off payments on January 1st of this year. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
The Oregon Office of Public Defense Services announced yesterday it would resume paying district attorneys discovery fees after stopping those payments early this year. Prosecutors have long charged public defenders for materials such as documents, recordings, and other evidence relevant to a criminal case against the very people the public defenders represented. The Office of Public Defense Services stopped paying prosecutors for those materials on January 1st. The policy shift came about because of changes made by lawmakers in 2021, as well as the fact a new director took over the Public Defense Office in December. Steve Singer, the executive director of the Office of Public Defense Services, said, quote, "This was never appropriate or proper from its inception. There is no provision in Oregon law that allows district attorneys or the state to pass these costs on to indigent criminal defendants," end quote. The decision to not pay discovery was controversial. Even some of the state's top Democrats were concerned the agency would no longer pay district attorneys to cover the cost of providing mandatory discovery. The lawmakers asked the Public Defense Office to reverse course. They stated in a letter, quote, "We believe that this decision is contrary to the legislature's intent to fund these costs. Indigent defendants themselves do not incur any costs related to the reimbursement of discovery fees, as such costs are borne by the state's general fund," end quote. Michael Wu, executive director for the Oregon District Attorneys Association, said, quote, "At a time when all offices are struggling with mounting caseloads and budgets are strapped, these funds are crucial for district attorney offices across the state to continue their duty to prosecute criminal cases," end quote. The Office of Public Defense Services spends roughly $6 million every 2 years on the discovery items. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky issued a fresh call for direct talks with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin on Tuesday, nearly a month into a war that has now forced more than 3.5 million people to flee Ukraine. Leaders around the world fear that Putin may turn to more aggressive tactics abroad as he tightens his grip at home. President Joe Biden has warned that Putin could resort to the use of chemical weapons in Ukraine now that, quote, his back is against the wall, end quote. This comes as officials say Biden may announce plans to permanently maintain an increased number of U.S. troops deployed in NATO countries near Ukraine. The sources said Biden, who is attending a NATO summit later this week, recently reviewed options for permanent increases in the number of troops in Eastern Europe. Biden also warned businesses in the U.S. to do more to protect themselves against possible cyber attacks by Russia. Russia has previously rejected allegations of planning cyber attacks, including accusations that it was responsible for hacks on Ukrainian banking and government websites in February. Also on Tuesday, a Russian court sentenced Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny to 9 years in a maximum security penal colony after he was convicted of fraud and contempt. Navalny, one of Putin's most prominent critics, is already serving a 2.5-year sentence in Russia for parole violations related to charges he says were fabricated to interfere with his political ambitions. Also, for the first time since the war began, the U.S. has assessed that Russia has lost some of its combat power, as Ukrainian forces were fighting to regain the town of Izium on Tuesday. A senior U.S. defense official said, quote, "We assess that for the first time, they may be just a little bit below 90%, and no tangible indications of reinforcements being brought in from elsewhere in the country," end quote. Over the last 24 hours, the U.S. has also observed that 7 Russian ships in the Sea of Azov have likely been firing to get to the south of Mariupol. Mariupol is an important port city, and if captured, could allow the Russians to pin down Ukrainian forces in the Donbas region and cut them off from Kyiv and the country's west. Republican Governor of Indiana, Eric Holcomb, vetoed a bill on Monday that would ban transgender female athletes from participating in girls' school sports. The Indiana law would have prohibited K-12 students who were born male but who identify as female from participating in a sport or on an athletic team that is designated for women or girls. However, it would not prevent students who identify as female or transgender men from playing on men's sports teams. Opponents of the bill argued it was a bigoted response to a problem that doesn't exist. The ACLU of Indiana said it had already planned a lawsuit against what it called, quote, hateful legislation, end quote. Republican sponsors of the bill said it was needed to protect the integrity of female sports and opportunities for girls to gain college athletic scholarships, but they were unable to point to any instances in the state of this being an issue. Although the governor signaled support for the bill last month, in his veto letter, he said the legislation falls short of providing consistent statewide policy for fairness in K-12 sports. Holcomb also pointed to the Indiana High School Athletic Association, which has a policy covering transgender students wanting to play sports that match their gender identity, and has said it has had no transgender girls finalize a request to play on a girls' team. Indiana lawmakers are able to override the governor's veto with simple majorities in both the House and Senate. A veto override vote could happen as soon as May 24th. 11 other Republican-led states have already enacted laws that ban transgender athletes from playing on certain sports teams. Many of those laws, including in Idaho, Florida, Tennessee, and West Virginia, are caught up in ongoing court battles. One of the largest conventions to come to Portland in over 2 years starts tomorrow, March 23rd. It's the Public Library Association's National Conference, and they expect more than 4,000 people to attend. The convention is an opportunity for librarians, library advocates, authors, and publishers to come together and discuss the challenges public libraries face today. KBOO's Althea Billings has more.
The Public Library Association's National Conference will be held in Portland from March 23rd to the 25th at the Oregon Convention Center. Melanie Huggins is the president of the Public Library Association. She says she's excited to get together after the years of the pandemic to tackle the issues facing libraries today.
We're going to use this as a real opportunity to, first of all, take a deep breath and celebrate the hard work that libraries have done over the last 2 years during a pandemic. So many things have happened in the last 2 years in our world and in our profession that have really challenged us, but I think brought libraries even more to the fore for people who always knew they were a good thing to have in their community but didn't quite realize the breadth and depth of work that libraries actually do.
Libraries have become a hub for a lot of community services, and Huggins said it took some adapting to make those services available even when the physical space of the library wasn't an option.
We had to figure out how to be a library, which is a very place-based organization, when people couldn't come to you. So a lot of innovative work into making sure that people still had broadband access in their homes, whether that was checking out MiFis or laptops, or in terms of education, getting books in the hands of children who were doing remote schooling. We got really creative about those partnerships and the ways that we reached out to communities. In addition, those of us who are already doing some innovative work, like, for example, having social workers in our libraries, really saw the value of being on the forefront of that trend, because those social workers were able to really assess and help needs of marginalized communities.
It's a challenging time in the library profession, and Huggins says she hopes people can better understand libraries as a community resource and one that is well poised to address a lot of the problems on the ground.
I think people finally get that we're not in the book business, that we are in the business of making sure our communities are educated and resilient and that they have high quality of life. So I think people understand that about public libraries. It doesn't mean that we don't have a passion for the written word and the spoken word and everything that falls in between. It's just that libraries are here to meet the needs of their local communities, and those needs are about answering those questions, helping them solve the problems, helping them advance their life in a way that is meaningful to them. And that might be by checking out a book. That might be by attending a class. That might be getting help with your resume. That might be help getting fresh produce from your public library because you're hungry. We are so well positioned to meet those disparities and help to fill those gaps and inequities that we see in our communities. And I hope people understand that that is the job of public libraries today.
The Public Library Association National Conference is taking place at the Oregon Convention Center from March 23rd to the 25th in Portland. For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. Then at 6, it's Preference, and at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 56 degrees. Today in history, in 1893, the first women's college basketball game is played at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. The game was organized by the college's gymnastics instructor, Lithuanian immigrant Senda Berenson, less than 2 years after the invention of the game by Dr. James Naismith. Berenson's rules were adapted from Naismith's rules for men, making basketball one of the rare sports that developed the male and female versions on a parallel timeline. The quote of the day is from American sprinter, Olympic champion, and sports icon Wilma Rudolph, who was the first American woman to win 3 gold medals in a single Olympic Games. Rudolph said, quote, "Never underestimate the power of dreams and the influence of the human spirit. We are all the same in this notion. The potential for greatness lives within each of us." Confirmation hearings begin for Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. 4 Marines killed in an airplane crash in Norway are identified, and the White House warns private companies to brace for cyber attacks. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It's about time that we have a highly qualified, highly accomplished Black woman on the Supreme Court. It's about time our highest court better reflects the country it serves.
Hawaiian Senator Mazie Hirono praised federal Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson on the first day of her confirmation hearings to succeed Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer when he retires this summer. Judge Jackson received bipartisan support for previous appointments, but some Republican senators are now attacking her record. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee dismissed Republican Missouri Senator Josh Hawley's claim that Brown has a history of leniency toward child sex offenders.
If I took his comments seriously, I'd be outraged, but they are hollow.
Ukrainian officials have refused Russia's demands to lay down their arms in Mariupol in exchange for the safe passage of civilians out of the southeastern port city. Benjamin Jensen at the Center for Strategic and International Studies says Russian forces have struggled to make meaningful progress in their attempt to take over Ukraine.
Most people seem to look at this conflict and still assume that it's some kind of insurgency, but the Ukrainians are still fighting in mechanized brigade-sized formations. That's large-scale combat operations.
Meanwhile, the Russian Foreign Ministry said its ties with the U.S. are on the verge of breaking over President Biden's comments to reporters last week, calling Russian President Vladimir Putin a war criminal. On Monday, White House cyber advisor Ann Neuberger called on private sector companies to shore up their cyber defenses.
Based on evolving threat intelligence, that the Russian government is exploring options for potential cyber attacks on critical infrastructure in the United States.
The U.S. Marines have identified 4 servicemen who died when their aircraft crashed in Norway during a NATO exercise the military says was unrelated to the Ukraine war. The cause of the crash is under investigation, but Norwegian police reported bad weather in the area, according to the Associated Press. The State Department said Monday it's restricting the visas of Chinese officials accused of repressive acts against ethnic and religious minorities. Finally, more than 20 years after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the U.S. government has stated the 5 men charged with that crime may never face a jury. Settlement talks are underway at the U.S. military court in Guantanamo Bay to allow alleged 9/11 architect Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his 4 co-defendants to plead guilty and serve life in prison. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe says racism and discrimination against Native people by businesses in Rapid City, South Dakota, will not be tolerated. And kelp forests in Washington State's Puget Sound play an important environmental and cultural role. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe says racism and discrimination against Native people by businesses in Rapid City, South Dakota will not be tolerated. Chairman Harold Frazier's comments follow social media posts made over the weekend by an owner of the Grand Gateway Hotel saying they'll ban Native American guests after a shooting at the property which injured a teenager. The Rapid City Journal reports the social media comment said, "We will no longer allow any Native American on property. And ranchers and travelers will receive a very special rate." In a statement, Frazier condemned the comments and is demanding an apology to the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota people. The city's mayor, Steve Allender, is also speaking out, saying the hotel does not reflect the community's values. The hotel did not respond to the journal for comment. Kelp forests in Puget Sound play a role environmentally and culturally, but they're in decline, as Eric Tigetoff reports.
There are more than 20 species of kelp in the region that are a vital source of food and habitat for marine animals. They also are important to indigenous people of the region. Todd Woodard, Natural Resources Director for the Samish Indian Nation, says tribal members have used kelp fronds as wraps to cook salmon and kelp bulbs to carry oil for heat and light and as rattles for young children.
It's a critical part of cultural identity to the Coast Salish people here. It's a critical part of the sense of place that indigenous populations have. And indigenous people, both on the First Nations and the tribe side, are working very hard to try and figure out what's happening and what can be done to mitigate for it.
Last summer, Puget Sound Restoration Fund brought together 200 people for an 8-day scientific exploration of kelp. It's part of an effort to implement the 2020 Puget Sound Kelp Conservation and Recovery Plan. The team is releasing videos of its expedition to raise awareness about kelp's decline. Betsy Peabody is executive director of the Puget Sound Restoration Fund. She says kelp is vital to the food web, which means they support iconic Northwest species such as salmon and orca. Peabody notes humans rely on Puget Sound's food web as well, and so the decline of kelp forests has a direct impact on people.
We're just wanting to work with others to really connect those dots in the way that we need to in order to support the conservation and restoration at a scale that can help protect these essential, iconic marine systems.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Joy Harjo says she's leaving the door open for other Indigenous artists, reflecting on her time as U.S. Poet Laureate. Harjo, Muscogee Creek, is the first Native American poet to serve in the position. She talked about breaking stereotypes during a virtual Mellon Foundation event on Monday.
When I get to the end of my life, I want Native people to be seen as human beings. And I think that's been one of the best things about the Poet Laureate position, because it's gone a long way for people to see that, there are poets.
Harjo says poetry is crucial, especially during times like the pandemic.
We lost our major culture bearers in our tribal nation, and that was true all over. But people, in these kinds of times, we go to poetry. There is such a need for what poetry does and what poetry gives us as human beings. That's why I think this laureateship has been noticeable, is because of that. It's because it's been, it's not really about me. It's really about the times we're in and the need, and how poetry has said, okay, I'm here and I've always been here.
Harjo was appointed Poet Laureate to the Library of Congress in 2019 and was reappointed in 2020. This is her third term in the role, which she's concluding. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Despite its economic and military might and close ties to Russia, China has balked at trying to press Vladimir Putin to stop the fighting in Ukraine. Even with calls from other world leaders to play a more proactive role, China has instead tried to keep its distance. It has urged peace, but not stepped up to mediate or organize talks, leaving such efforts to smaller powers, including France, Turkey, and Israel. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
One of the more interesting developments in Putin's war on Ukraine is the retreat of China from support of Russia. When the Russian invasion began, many experts were alarmed by the Putin-Xi final statement as the Winter Olympics closed, specifically its reference to no limits in Sino-Russian relations. As I've mentioned in a previous commentary, that conclusion was mistaken. Since then, Chinese support of Russia has gradually eroded. 2 days before Russia's invasion, China's foreign minister said the, quote, sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity of any country should be respected and safeguarded. Ukraine is no exception, he said. China did not recognize the two people's republics proclaimed by Putin in eastern Ukraine. China abstained from voting on 2 UN resolutions that condemned Russia's invasion. Beijing continues to support Russia's legitimate security concerns, quote unquote, but it has not done much so far to alleviate Russia's economic pain from the U.S. and European sanctions. Even though China began purchasing Russian wheat and increased imports of Russian gas, 2 of its main banks abided by U.S. sanctions in refusing to issue dollar-denominated letters of credit for purchases of Russian goods. Sanctions, said Xi Jinping, will affect global finance, energy, transportation, and stability of supply chains, and dampen a global economy that is already ravaged by the pandemic. And that's in nobody's interests, he said, clearly meaning China's. It appears that Chinese support for Russia has softened in direct proportion to Russia's military failures, Ukrainian resistance, and the unprecedented array of sanctions on Russian trade, banking, and overseas investments. Not only are China's economy and trade likely to be affected, its leadership surely must be as unnerved as Western leaders are on hearing Putin raise the possibility of using nuclear weapons. And Chinese leaders surely took note of how European governments, including those that are not NATO members, are now united in defense of Ukraine. Thus, China's emphasis has shifted to promoting a diplomatic resolution over Ukraine, urging the parties to seek reasonable solutions, even as Beijing's mass media keep repeating Putin's disinformation campaign on Ukraine. But here's the rub. When it comes to actively playing a peacemaker's role, Beijing has balked. In a word, China has so far failed the global leadership test. Far from being a responsible great power, as it calls itself, it has chosen to straddle the fence at a defining moment in European and perhaps global security. To be sure, Beijing may have been caught flat-footed by the scope of Putin's ambitions, but it has had plenty of time to recover. Instead, China is offering platitudes and weak offers to mediate, such as expressions of a willingness to play a constructive role in peace talks and work together with the international community. Pure self-interest, removal of sanctions, which might one day be imposed on China if it were ever to attack Taiwan, is the main factor in China's position on Ukraine, not humanitarian concerns, Russia's war of aggression, or the Russian aim to convert Ukraine into a vassal state. Beijing's leaders have not taken actions that could elevate China's international standing, such as initiating a peace conference of the major players, calling for a ceasefire, or sending substantial aid to Ukraine. Now Putin is calling upon China to provide military and economic aid to Russia. The Biden administration's approach has been to warn Beijing not to provide substantial new aid to Russia. Instead, why not offer incentives that will begin to move U.S.-China relations in a positive direction? Incentives could mean removing Trump-era tariffs, ending visa restrictions on Chinese visitors, and proposing resumption of pandemic research. Officially, the Chinese are sticking to their position of respect for Ukraine's sovereignty and respect for Russia's security concerns. But there are voices in Beijing that want a turnaround in relations and recognize how the disaster in Ukraine could badly impact China. Xi told Biden in their phone conversation of March 18, "We should not only steer China-U.S. relations forward on the right track, but we should also shoulder our international responsibilities and strive for world peace and tranquility." There may be an opening here. Biden should seize it, even though the March 18 call showed no movement in China's position on Ukraine. What goes on behind the scenes may be more hopeful. Thanks for listening. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 22nd, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez and Nadia Ramlagan. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kbu.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly show about the ongoing interaction of police and communities in Portland. My name is Sam, and this show is also produced by Jasmine, who we'll hear from in a minute. For this month's show, we spoke with Teresa Rayford, longtime Portland activist and founder of Don't Shoot Portland, and a former candidate for Multnomah County Sheriff, and most recently, Portland Mayor in 2020. We checked in about some of Don't Shoot Portland's ongoing legal and educational efforts, including the ongoing lawsuit that brought to light racist training materials used by the Portland Police Bureau's crowd control team, and multiple restraining orders that attempted to rein in police use of chemical weapons during the 2020 protests. Don't Shoot is also involved in a number of initiatives to reclaim black history and culture in Portland, including rehabilitation of historic buildings in Albina, and a project called Liberated Archives that uses archival materials to document the experience of people of color at the hands of the state, media, and white majority in Portland and across the country. Teresa also spoke about her growth as an activist and how the movement for black lives in Portland has changed over time, and how she and other community members are exploring ways to address a rise in gun violence without relying on the police. The whole interview is about 50 minutes long, so we'll be airing it in two chunks, the first part tonight and the second part tomorrow night, Wednesday, March 23rd.